You're listening to Ruining It for Everyone with your hosts Maggie McPhee and Christopher Harrington. Episode 11, Snow Monkey. So how was your week?
What did I do last week? Well, I've moved into my new space at Artisan Asylum. I've been doing a lot of work in there and getting settled in, and it's really great. So that's been a lot of fun. A lot of work, but a lot of fun. I got the MakerBots there, my robots there, everything else, and my new benches set up and all that, and it's been pretty cool.
So you fully moved in?
Yep.
Excellent.
Are you interested in any way in what such a thing might cost?
Oh, see, I was just going to let it be. but yeah, actually, I am curious because I love the idea of having a hacker space available. Obviously, I'm several hundred miles away. Well, a couple hundred miles away. I imagine there are listeners in major metropolitan areas that do have hacker spaces, like, for example, in New York or in San Francisco or perhaps even in the Boston-Cambridge area. How much does that sort of thing usually cost?
There's varying levels of membership. So you pay a membership for, you know, the entire space, because there's a machine shop, there's a wood shop, there's welding bays, there's a chemical room, you know, there's the whole nine yards that everyone gets to share. So there's a membership for that. And then if you rent a space, that's additional, anywhere from a shelf up to, I don't know how big the biggest rooms are. There are closed rooms, and then everything else is kind of a shared open space where you have your demarcated walled off area of like 50 square foot or 100 square foot or something like that.
Oh, so it's actually walled off. That's interesting. It's not just like, you know, tape down on the floor. Like, this is my space and you will not, you know, very Les Nessman-like, which, wow, that dates me.
Yeah, the walls, you know, it's like a just above hip level wall that demarcates your space.
Oh, that's cool.
And like a 50 square foot space is $75 a month.
Oh, wow. That's perfectly reasonable.
Yeah. It's absolutely reasonable. Yeah.
Very, very cool. Yeah. I was thinking more along the lines of something like that would be, you know, $150 or $200 a month. But yeah, no, that's brilliant. That's very doable.
Of course, you know, the you're paying your monthly.
Right. It's on top of your monthly membership fee, certainly. Right. But still, you know, that's.
It's quite reasonable. Yeah. Even so.
No, that's great. That's really affordable, because that's the other thing as well. You know, it's one thing to have the hackerspace, but if it's not accessible to people because it's too expensive, then, you know, it's kind of not fulfilling its duty as a community thing.
Right. They have a lot of renters. So, you know, it really seems to work out because, you know, it's popular. People need, you know, this sort of thing.
Yeah.
What are you up to this week?
Oh, lots of stuff happened this week. Part two of my guest hosting on Scruffy Thinking was released, which is called Tangent Cafe, I believe, because we are quite literally all over the map in that one. I actually felt really bad for Kanan trying to edit something that was worthwhile out of it. There was some interesting stuff. Mostly it was blather about work and my former employer. So that's good times. As I say, nothing really bad. Just we got a little real. We got a little real. So there was that, which is cool. We had Kanan Volume 2. That was also a lot of fun, I thought. Yep. And those will be out shortly. Hopefully, by the time you listen to this, if not, we've got big problems.
Yeah, we might have an ordering problem if that were the case.
Yeah, exactly. The other tragic thing that happened to me over the week was I was informed by Kimpton Hotels that I'm no longer a Kimpton Inner Circle member. And I know I'm taking that very, very hard. Kimpton is a hotel chain in the US. I think they may have some internationally, but it's mostly around the US. They are based out of San Francisco, but they've got hotels all over the place. And in a lot of places that I travel, I love them. They're a small boutique hotel chain. They've got neat rooms, and the hotels themselves are usually themed. There are a few in DC, one of which is called The Rouge in the DuPont Circle, sort of the greater DuPont Circle area. The lobby has faux red dyed eel skin wall coverings.
Oh, so it's not like Mickey, Goofy, Minnie.
No.
Not that kind of theme?
Not that kind of theme at all. More crazy brothel, sort of modern crazy brothel in that theme. It's a hell of a lot of fun. Everyone there is always super nice. And so I like to go and use those hotels as often as I can. I had one very, very bad experience there once. I wrote to them, and the head of the food chain phoned me back, and we had a long conversation. She really wanted to A, apologize, but also make it right. And one of the things that she did was that she put me in the inner circle, which provides a whole host of fun benefits. So if there's an empty space in one of the suites, you automatically get upgraded. You get a personal concierge, which is also quite lovely. All sorts of really fun perks. I use the hell out of them for a really long time. I was informed via a fairly automatic letter in email saying that I was no longer an Inner Circle member. That doesn't mean I'm not going to use them. I do like the place, but it also means that I'm not exclusive to them anymore. I don't feel compelled to use them, which is a bit
don't
unfortunate.
Don't worry. You've said brothel, use the hell out of. I'm going to edit that down. It'd be really, really interesting.
Oh, I imagine you will. The other thing is that we seem to be in the bit of the vanguard talking about the implications of iBooks and iBooks textbooks on the school system. And I thought that the MacBreak Weekly that came out was a bit insane. As apparently you did as well, based on your tweets.
Well, I also must point out that half of those tweets were under the influence of alcohol. But
yeah, but you know what? That's only letting the inner truth come out.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know the saying, "Drunk man's words are sober man's thoughts."
Indeed, indeed. I'm going to use that. I've not actually heard that phrase, but is that Oscar Wilde?
My dad.
Oh, know. There we are. I was going to say, it certainly sounds very Oscar Wilde-ish.
I'm sure it comes from somewhere.
There we are.
I may have been a bit harsh on the tweets, but well, yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people, I mean, there are other people talking about it as well, but I think one of the problems is a lot of people in either, you know, tech journalism or tech podcasting and that sort of thing are looking at it in the same way that they look at consumer or business applications and you know the impact, and they're looking at it the same way, and there's so much that's just not the same, and there's so much that's changed between Apple and the education market that a lot of people still seem to have that same sort of mindset that, you know, things are the same as they used to be, and they're not even close to being like they used to be.
Right. And also just that, you know, the tech journalists and such, they simply don't know or understand the education space, or at least in the K-12 education space. And we made that big distinction where K-12 is a very, very different animal from higher education. You know,
right.
it's just, you know, budgets are different, government is far more involved. All those things contribute to an entirely different environment. And a lot of what I was listening to and a lot of what I read didn't seem to address that or even understand it or acknowledge it.
Right. Even the most basic thing, like the iTunes store, is not built to help education markets in any way. You know, iTunes U, sure, but the store is built for a one-to-one relationship with an individual and their purchases. And then the device, the iOS devices, follow on from that. Each device is tied to a user, the user's data, it's, you know, et cetera, on down. And the educational market is very not user-centric. It's, you know, many to one. We've discussed it before. It's the many to one versus the one to one.
Only when Apple can address that can they really go into the education market.
Right. It took us months and months and months just to figure out how can we buy OS X Lion. And it was like, you know, everyone had to work around it until Apple released a statement saying how it would happen. But it was like, okay. And we're waiting and we're waiting and we're waiting. And months later, it's like, okay, now you can buy this certificate thing with a number. It's like, I'm just not expecting that they're going to be making a lot of quick changes to anything.
Right.
I think they're going to force the educators to have to figure it out. And a lot of people are doing crazy stuff to try to work things out. I know of, you know, schools where they've been using iOS devices for various things. And they're like, so how do we do this? Well, we can't buy this app, or we can't buy a number of this app because there's no way to do it. So the parents go get gift cards out, you know, iTunes gift cards and buy them for the school, you know, and this is crazy stuff like that. That's just, you know.
Yeah, that's not sustainable in any way, shape or form. Right. The other thing that happened this week was the announcement of Mountain Lion, the new operating system to surpass Lion, which I keep on wanting to call Snow Lion or I guess
call Snow Monkey.
I think Snow Monkey is going to work. I think that's perfect. They said a few very intriguing things to me. One, they decided to have a handful of journalists come in one-on-one, and they would basically give them a little mini keynote. And that doesn't normally happen in quite the same way. Yeah. You know, back in the day, it used to be a whole bunch of journalists in a room. They'd give the keynote or they'd give the presentation. And then if the journalists had questions, they would be pulled in individually. And then the journalists could ask the question and Apple can either answer the question or deflect or what have you. This was very interesting because it was a one-on-one presentation. So Gruber was brought into a room where Phil Schiller talked at him for 45 minutes or an hour or whatever it was about the new features of the operating system. And that's very on what we knew Apple to be. So right. That's a very different thing in this sort of post-Jobs era.
There was a lot of, in the past, there was a very much a focus on controlling the message that goes to the masses, whereas this was controlling the message that goes to each individual, which is kind of really weird.
Yeah, because eventually, you know, they're going to talk and they're going to, you know, obviously they were embargoed for a week. That allowed them lead time to write their articles. But, you know, I imagine these are all fairly professional journalists at the top of their game. I don't see an avenue where no one asked a release date or no one asked something that, you know, that they were going to answer. I mean, I imagine everyone asks the same basic things and Apple is going to answer them or not answer them however they see fit. And so they had a week to play with the operating system and write their, do their write-up. And 1 week later, they announce it to the general public, which I thought was really interesting as well.
Yeah, it's very strange that it's, you know, it's like, what, it's one thing talking to people out of band and sizing them up for something that's coming in the future. But then to have that thing, if I were them and had not known any better, I would have assumed that this is, you know, this is the early preview start. This is the start of the preview thing, you know. Mm-hmm. And next thing you know, they turn around and they announce it and they say this summer. So my first question would have been, didn't you just release a brand new operating system last summer?
Well, yeah. You know, and so a few things came out of that are very suspicious to my tinfoil hatted brain. One, a big change to me, which is probably a very small change to them, but my conspiracy theory hat says they dropped the word Mac from Mac OS X. So it's now just OS X. And they also, and they've been doing this since Lion, but they tend not to talk about the number. So it's not really OS X Lion. It's not OS X 10.7 Lion. It is simply OS X Lion, or in this case, OS X Snow Lion, Mountain Lion, or Molo, apparently, some people are calling it, which is a little more insane.
Yeah, now, yes, it's Apple OS X.
Right, and then the cat name. So that says to me, their mantra, the thing that they've been saying over and over again, I guess in hopes that we would buy it, is that the Mac is still very, very important. And I suppose it is on some level, but it's pretty clear that the future is very much focused on the mobile space. You know, right. It's also very clear that all of the new features of Lion, even, and of Snow Lion and of Mountain Lion are iOS to the Mac. There's right. Not a lot of stuff going from the Mac to iOS.
And well, it's gone already. All of that's already gone. What's going to go to iOS is already gone.
Right. And what went to iOS initially was the kernel, some of the frameworks, the base frameworks that comprise macOS. But everything new is being developed first for iOS and then being backported to the desktop. And that's a big change from what we're used to with regard to general computing.
I will say, though, that playing devil's advocate, the fact that this is coming on the heels, and we all know that the integration is coming in some form or another. We just don't know whether it kills the laptop desktop market space or not, or how soon it kills it, I guess, is really a question.
But right. I think it's an eventuality.
It's an eventuality, but is it a 10-year eventuality or is it a 25-year eventuality?
You know? Or is it a 5-year eventuality? I mean, they could iMac their own line, really.
Right, but the thing about this is like the fact that they are announcing a new operating system, which it's not a rededication to the platform, but it does still kind of say that, you know, we're still looking at this. So it's not like we've, you know... Well, they could have just gone and let Mac OS X go stale. We could be, you know, running OS 10.7.9 at some point. You know, they could have done that, but it's clear that they are still doing developing and they want to at least start this convergence in an orderly fashion.
Right. Well, so. I think that's exactly it. I think it really is a convergence. I think the lines are blurring between iOS and OS 10 to the point where in the very near future, there's going to be one OS. And yes, it's going to be different.
It's going to behave differently.
Right, because it's a different thing, right? You've got mouse and keyboard versus touch. I also think that as the desktop matures, we're going to see more touch involved in the desktop. Again, the whole idea of the touch-based iMac is going to come into existence, but you're still going to want a real keyboard. I mean, you're not going to touch type like you would on an iPad, on an iMac. That's just not efficient.
No, I mean, on a desktop, it's almost ridiculous. On a laptop, maybe, but no one wants to reach across their desk to touch their screen.
Well, the idea is that the screen isn't necessarily going to be in the position that it currently is right now, you know, which
but
is going to be...
But then why even make a desktop?
Well, because it's a gigantic screen. You know, it's a gigantic screen that you can tilt almost like a
well,
light
we
box.
Talked about that before.
It's
I guess
true.
This is where I disagree. It's like if you make the screen larger, you don't pull it closer. That's the inverse of what happens with a large screen. The larger the screen gets, the further away it goes. The way I would see it is, my opinion, if they move to this, you're going to be using a different input device like an iPad to control your big display.
Oh, see, I just view it as a Cintiq made better. You know, the Wacom Cintiq.
I just don't see Apple doing it.
Yeah, no, and that's cool. I mean, they do have the patents on them and such like that. So if they do decide to go in that direction, you know, they're the ones holding all the cards, which is, you know, which is good for them. But right. I think that also this new operating system worries me a little bit because Lion is ridiculously unstable still. You know, to the point where, you know, I on my main machine, I refuse to upgrade to it because it's broken in a lot of very important ways that involve my work. The idea that they're just going to throw out a new operating system, that scares me because that means that they never stabilized Lion. So what's the guarantee that this new Mountain Lion is going to be more stable? And if they are on a track that is now yearly, rather than every 18 months or so, 18 to 24 months, for not only OS X, but also for iOS, what does that mean exactly? I mean, it sounds to me like they're ramping up and doing way more than they can possibly do well.
They may also just be realigning so that doing two things, getting this new operating system with all these things in it that they want to add, and also realigning the release cycle so that it's more in line with their iOS cycle, even if they don't do the 12 to 18 months on OS X, at least they can be somewhere in this ballpark. I don't know. Mm. It is kind of odd all around.
The other possibility is that the new OS is simply, or future versions of the OS are simply going to be smaller in scope. You know, they're going to be Snow Leopard-ish in that Snow Leopard, well, maybe not Snow Leopard-ish, but to the public, Snow Leopard was viewed as a small upgrade to Leopard. In reality, there was a huge number of under-the-hood changes. However, they announced, you know, quote-unquote, no new features. And it's possible that even though Mountain Lion has a bunch of new features, those features are maybe they're easier to implement. For example, we've seen on Apple's website, you know, the new calendar app, which is iCal reskinned and renamed. We have iMessages, which is really just, we have Messages, which is iMessage ported to the Mac, which takes over iChat. It is the new iChat, and you can actually download that if you're a civilian. You can download that and check it out if you've got 10.7.3 beta, and you know, and that's kind of interesting. But I wonder if you know these future updates are just going to be smaller in scope. You know,
yeah, I can totally see that happening. Where this is like the okay, here's the big realignment going forward. That 10.8 is their starting point for that. You know, we might add things, but this is our core. And until we do a real big core change, everything else is either incremental or it's just something we give you extra. You know, instead of like a release, we'll put more apps or put more things in individually. That could very well happen.
Another thing that shocked me a little bit was going back to how they announced the new operating system. The fact that it didn't hit the front page. I mean, it hit a small area of the front page, but it wasn't the big dynamic lead.
Well, I told you about the video, right?
Oh yeah, you thought it was a fake.
I thought it was a joke.
Yeah,
I thought it was a hoax. I'm like, this is very good, but you know, this is clearly not real. So I stopped watching.
Yeah. And I mean, it's crazy. So, you know, that's a little bit strange. And also, normally OS upgrades have a big announcement associated with them. You know,
it's almost as though they don't want people to talk about it.
It's a little weird, you know, and if iBooks is so important that they had this gigantic event, but a new the new desktop operating system is not so important that not only does it not get an event, but it also doesn't even get proper time on the homepage.
Yeah.
That's a little unfortunate. And to me, it's what they say versus what they do. They say, oh yeah, it's back to the Mac and everything is cool with, you know, the desktop and we didn't leave you guys out and we still believe in the desktop. And yet they do this other thing, which is to undermine the desktop, which is to say we're going to drop the word Mac from the operating system. We're not really going to publicize it on our website. I mean, yes, they do have an entire area devoted to it, but normally when something like that happens, the dynamic lead and the front page is taken over by the new shiny thing. And
right, it's kind of like, all right, here's this thing, guys, and I mean, so there's that thing. All right, yeah, it's no big deal. Oh, and look, here's Messages. Isn't this cool? You know, let's talk about this.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the other thing.
Yeah, so it's really, really strange. Why would you announce something like this to a bit of a whimper? You know, it seems to me that if they're going to, in the past, they've given more time and fanfare to the desktop operating system. And now it is very, in my mind anyway, based upon their actions, the desktop operating system is very much a second-class citizen.
Right. And it feels to me like this was a necessity for them that they also realized they had to announce to some degree. So, well, we're going to have to tell them about this and get this out there. But we got to get this out there and move on.
Right. So, and then also, while developers do have access to the early edition, normally that happens during WWDC, the Worldwide Developer Conference, which means that, yes, the developers get to take it home while they're at the conference, but they also learn all about it at the conference as well.
Right, which is a usually a big deal, you know, because especially if it's, you know, any sort of new under the hood technologies, you want to have a nice long session and talk to people about it. But this was just like, oh yeah, and here's a new operating system.
Yeah, it was entirely, it was a press event, a weird press event. And while developers certainly have access to it and have been using it, there's no follow-up, really. There's no classes, there's no tracks, there's no in-depth, what is this all about? Please help me orient so that I can create new, better, exciting products.
Yeah,
there was really, none of that.
Yeah, I mean, it's just strange. I'm like, you mean I can download this now already? There's no interim waiting. But then I was thinking, well, I'm still fiddling with OS 10.7 at work, so yeah. I might have to wait a while before I do too much. I guess I shouldn't say much more, but...
Well, that's the thing as well, which is, you know, institutions, you know, large corporations or even small corporations, you know, as well as educational institutions and such, you know, they need time. You know, they need time to evaluate the new stuff, to run it through its paces, to make sure everything's going to work properly, etc. And then they'll roll it out. So they usually roll out fairly late. So if you are going to have a schedule that is yearly and the stability is still not quite there,
right.
I imagine adoption for corporations and such, which admittedly is in the Mac universe is far smaller than the general population home use.
And tends to be treated that way by Apple these days. There's no, you know.
So I'm wondering if it's just the, screw it, we're catering to, you know, the home user, and we don't really care if your institution can't keep up.
You're right. Including your education, although we want your business in this other stuff, you know.
Well, they want your business. Well, they want your business in the mobile space. They right. want it. They want to gently push everyone to mobile, or at least it seems that way, according to their actions.
We just have this same fight with Mozilla, you know, over their,
right.
their artificial release cycles, and the stability just suddenly went to crap, and it was like people had to push on them to get them to recognize that, you know, corporations, there's you know, the cycle, there's no way around it. For instance, going back to 10.7, we couldn't even put the machines on our network until 10.2, 7.2, or 10.7.3. They just literally would not work.
Really? Was it the Kerberos stuff that you've got going on?
Yeah.
It broke a lot of stuff, which is actually interesting because that's one of the main topics that I wanted to get to, which was the new security features in Mountain Lion and what that means sort of in general. So Mountain Lion expands on some of the security features that have been going on in macOS for a really long time. Lion introduced the idea of sandboxing as an optional component to your application. They also introduced code signing. So any application that's on the App Store has to be signed. Basically what that does is it binds the sort of a developer signature into an application so that you can guarantee the author that you think created this application, the origin of this application, really is in fact the correct origin. It's a way of making malware more difficult to infiltrate your system.
Right, you have someone to go back to if they do something shonky.
Snow Lion comes in with this sort of new added thing. They enforce a sandboxing, which means that every app is effectively in its own Chroot jail, which means that it has very, very limited access to anything else outside of its own binary. So it does not have access to your general file system. It does not have access to the network stack. It does not have access to all the stuff that an application used to be able to have by default, which is going to change the nature of a lot of applications out there, which is really, really kind of weird to me. I understand that what good sandboxing will bring, you know, the idea, it, just like on iOS, all iOS apps are sandboxed. So that means
right.
that so
it's not a bad thing inherently. It's always about execution.
Right. One of my big gripes on iOS is, yes, it's a smaller, scaled down mobile system. So there are certain trade-offs you have to deal with, but it's a giant pain in the ass to exchange files between application A and application B. And if I have to deal with that in a sandbox environment on my desktop, because I'm highly automated on my machines. I have Unix scripts talking to applications, which will send and receive data back and forth. They will wait for a particular operation to finish and then take the output and then put it into another application, you know, automated type scripts, but a little bit more complex than that. In a purely sandbox model, that's going to be much more difficult to do, or maybe even not even possible.
Well, to be clear too, the initial release of Gatekeeper appears to allow you to, you know, to change the levels at which your machine allows things.
Right. And so there are three levels now. There's the, you're only able to run applications from the App Store. You can run any application from the App Store or these signed applications. Or three, which is the, you can run anything you want, go crazy.
Right.
If you have a mixture of sandboxed applications and non-sandboxed applications, if you choose the least secure version, oh, and by the way, the by default, Mountain Lion uses the second option, which is
right.
any app from the App Store or signed applications. And of course, a signed application means that Apple at any time can decide that your application is malware or it doesn't like it and nuke it from orbit. So make sure it doesn't run. I'm wondering, because I'm hearing publicly on the net that the signing is checked on first run, and then it's basically flagged, much like Quarantine currently works for downloaded Safari items. So if you download a JPEG or download or whatever from the net, when you double-click on that icon, it's going to ask you, hey, you downloaded this thing from the net. Are you sure you want to launch it?
Right.
You know, it's a very similar thing to that.
And your machine gets keys, hopefully on a regular basis every day from Apple.
So I've heard that it only checks the first time and then it flags it as good or bad, you know, depending on if you've, you know, decided to say, no, I don't want to run this. And then it's basically granted. If that's the case, then Apple can't shut off a rogue app because it no longer checks.
Well, it also means that your apps will continue to work when you're not connected to the internet. So,
well, that's the other thing as well. So if it doesn't only check once and it checks every time it launches, that assumes a connection to the internet, which is not necessarily there. And that's
there's no way they can do that. It may, I assume that it would do first run and then each, and then when a binary is changed. Otherwise, it would just cause havoc.
But
I mean, you can do it on a mobile phone because, in theory, there's always a data connection. You could, but it's still probably not a good idea.
I'm very curious as to how that's going to pan out because I don't think that those two items, the sandboxing and the code signing, are really going to change the landscape too much. The reason I think that is an individual user isn't really the target for data collection necessarily. They are targets for being a bot. These malicious people want to use your computer for their own purposes, but they're not really interested in your data on your computer because it's just inefficient. You know, there's no reason for that. But they do want to use your computer as a zombie so that they can do whatever they want, you know, with your resources. And that basically means becoming part of a botnet. To that end, what they want to do is they want to target the big companies with the big databases, with all the credit card information and all the other information that you have as personal information, where they can bang list A against list B and list C. And maybe all those lists happen to be semi-anonymous, but together you can actually glean personal data.
My credit card.
Precisely, exactly. I mean, you had that happen, you know, the other week. you know, where your credit card wasn't directly compromised, but it was indirectly compromised because, you know, they took list A and found list B and cross-referenced it and basically said, oh, we've got a credit card number here.
And let's try this address and name, and if it works, it works.
Exactly. You know, because there's no real penalty for getting it wrong. Right. So you just keep banging on it until you get the right one. I'm a little bit curious as to what all that tying down is really doing for real security. It seems to me that at the moment, this is a gentle push for developers to get on board with the idea of signing their own code. Actually, technically, it's Apple sign. Well, yeah. It's Apple doing...
Apple is their authority.
Right. Yeah, the developers are signing their code. And the next step is getting developers to get on board with the App Store. And I mean, obviously, a huge number of developers are already on board with the App Store thing, which is all super groovy. However, there are some holdouts. And there are some holdouts because there are certain licenses that are not compatible with the App Store, such as the GPL, at least it wasn't at one point in time. I'm pretty sure it still isn't. And so you can't necessarily code sign that stuff either, which means that a lot of people who are honest coders, they're left out in the cold because the default is to only allow things that are signed or only allow things from the App Store. But I think this is also one push toward an App Store only OS 10 or OS 11 or whenever that eventually happens. Because I think it's a slow process. Because right now, if you wish to have certain new features of Mountain Lion, you must be in the App Store. It's not even just a code signing thing. You must actually be in the App Store. In order to use iCloud services, you must submit your app for approval in the App Store.
Right.
Which
is going to stifle some things in the future, which is, to me, is a bit sad. If Shirt Pocket decides they want to do something and, well, sorry, you can't put your app in the App Store because of the way it works, and therefore you have no access to any of this other stuff.
You're already bifurcating and creating second-class citizens of non-App Store apps. And on one hand, I get it. Because, okay, if you're going to use iCloud, you know, that's Apple's thing and Apple owns it and it's free.
But
at the same time,
for the user, it's a matter of all your integration, and it's pushed to you from Apple as solving your problems. So therefore you're going to adopt it. It's part and parcel of iOS, and you're the free things you get from them. It's a real double-edged sword, but it's a sword that's going to cut some people.
Yeah, I think it's going to cut a lot of people. I mean, already there are apps that are bifurcated. For example, BB Edit, the app that I live in and love with all of my heart, the App Store version is different from the version that you buy directly through them. In order to get the full functionality, you actually have to then go to BB Edit, to Barebones site, and then download a second binary, which fills in the blanks of what's in the App Store in the form of helper applications, which is a little bit silly. I mean, now that means that, you know, if you want this advanced functionality, which may not work in the future because of the sandboxing and all of this other stuff, you may not have the opportunity to have helper applications even exist.
So going back to ShirtPocket, for instance, has SuperDuper, can't put it in the App Store because, it needs low-level file access and things like that. So it can never be in the App Store. So they won't be able to take advantage of saying, let's have all of your SuperDuper preferences or list of your backed up volumes is available on iCloud. They can't do it because they can't put their app in the store.
There's just massive swaths of functionality that we've taken for granted for 20 plus years that are suddenly no longer available to us, theoretically in the name of safety, but the Mac has always been quote unquote secure enough, on some level. Again, they're still not really major targets. And of course, that's an inevitability. You can only be safe for so long. Right. Well, it's true. But I mean, it's held up for now. But who knows in 2 years and 3 years? We're seeing increased Mac sales every year, despite the fact that the PC sales have been declining in the last couple of quarters. You know, it's entirely possible that one day it will be a target.
It's possible, but so far, statistically, not very probable. But that, I guess, you know, that's a different story, especially if Apple keeps... maybe not performing up to par, but I think this whole thing really is just about that move to iOS. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's about safety ostensibly, but it's about safety for iOS. And we need to move these other devices into this same sort of model that we have with, you know, iOS.
Well, and
because
that
eventually they are all going to, you know, share this thing.
Well, I think that model really is we want 30% of everything.
Well, there's that too.
And you know, good on them for trying that. You know, I think that's really cool. I think, you know, that also means that I'm going to be stuck on 10.6.8 for the rest of my existence or move to another platform. I mean, that really comes down to it. With regard to the sandboxing, there are ways to bust out of that sandbox through what they call entitlements. And these entitlements do certain things, like, for example, oh, I need to be able to open and save files of a particular file type. What that does is, and this happens in Lion, basically a special open save dialog box pops up. The application itself calls a helper application that creates an open save file dialog, which does not give any information to the parent application with regard to the actual true file path. So the application itself has no idea where this file is going or where it will be. It only has this sort of weird, bizarro world view of the file structure.
Right. If I understand it correctly, it can say, this is where I think it should go, and the helper can do with that what it wishes. And then, okay, the user has done something. Here's the file that it needs to save, and then returns a, here is where it actually ended up.
Right. It's all, again, a weird approximation because of the parent application's view of the file system is not real. It's a weird sort of alternate universe where that application is the only thing that exists on the entire file system.
And for most applications, that's fine. But for some applications, not so much.
Well, right. You know, for example, it used to be the case where you would create a file in one application, and let's say, for sake of argument, Photoshop, right? You create a Photoshop file, you bang out a JPEG version of your PSD. So you've got this JPEG. Chances are fairly good you don't ever want to open up that JPEG in Photoshop. You really want to open it up in Preview or maybe in Safari or something like that. You're really not able to do that anymore in this new world order, which is very annoying to me. The whole idea of creating text files and then only having them open by their creator is very tedious.
This whole thing's going to drive Adobe in particular mad because they're so bad about doing all this stuff on their own. They're homegrown file dialogues and ways of statting files that don't work on certain file systems. So this will drive them crazy. But
well, I'm also wondering if Adobe is going to bother with code signing. And wouldn't that be interesting when everyone upgrades and you get a fairly ominous dialogue box that says, hey, you're trying to launch this thing and you told us that you didn't want to allow that to happen. Are you, do you want to make your system slightly more slightly more insecure? Launch or don't launch or trash?
That's the other thing. Yeah. Will it just be a constant changing of these values depending on, you know, what you're installing? And maybe that's good too, because it makes the user more aware, but eventually people are just going to click to the third option.
I mean, that's what happens on Windows as well, right? You know, you're constantly bombarded by questions of, are you sure you want to run this? This may like do bad things. And of course you want to run it because it's the thing that you downloaded and you know, probably okay.
This site in Malaysia is probably just fine.
Yeah, exactly. The problem with that is that you get fatigued. You know, you see that dialogue box every day, several times a day.
Story of my life. I'm like, what was the error? I don't know. I just click those things.
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Yeah. And and so you click OK, and suddenly you realize that all of your apps are running outside, or worse yet, I believe the default is to trash the app. That's not cool at all.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So that's really, really not cool.
You know, I really do believe, though, that, you know, Apple's always looking a lot farther ahead than we're generally talking about. I believe that in their heads, they're looking towards a world where there is ubiquitous connectivity and that they will be able to do all this stuff on the fly. And it's just, there's going to be a lot of pain and suffering before that's ever the case.
I think there's certainly going to be more pain and suffering than not. But I also think that developers will hem and haw, certainly, and then they'll just do it. They'll just go with it.
Right. Yeah. Because, you know, Apple, the other thing they're moving towards is iCloud.
Right. Apple's new world order is iCloud. iCloud is the center of everything. 5 years ago, or was it 10 years ago now? Oh, goodness. You know, when the iPod came out, you know, when they had the whole idea of the digital hub and the Mac was the center of that digital hub. Well, now the new center of that hub is iCloud. And right. You have devices, and it doesn't really matter what devices they are. Maybe it's a desktop machine, maybe it's a laptop, maybe it's an iPod, maybe it's an iPhone or an iPad. But it's iCloud that is the new thing that Apple cares about.
Right. There is no hub. There is only Zool. I mean, iCloud.
Whichever. If someone asks you if you're a god, you say yes. And so that's a very interesting turn of events. When you're dealing with the cloud, where is your data really? In Apple's case, we know that they've got their giant server farm. So that's pretty obvious. What interests me, though, is Apple's not the only one storing important information in the cloud. There are a huge number of other companies that are storing stuff in the cloud. For example, Path was recently discovered to upload your entire address book into their servers, ostensibly unencrypted. Yes, it was via an SSL connection, but the data inside that SSL connection was clear text. So when it wound up on their servers, in their databases, it was clear, in the clear, in their MySQL database or whatever they're using. And it scares me a little bit that, you know, here we have all these apps, and what makes these apps so powerful and so wonderful is that they're connected to the internet. So, you know, I may do something locally, and I may even be offline while doing it, but I know that the second I am online, everything will synchronize, and I will have all of my updates propagated to all of my devices, and everything just kind of works. But at the same time, I don't know how they are storing my information.
Well, because you don't have an agreement with them about how they will or will not store your information, how it's vetted and things like that, which you do with Apple or iCloud, you do with Amazon or Google. And that's really where this problem lies. I mean, we're already talking about the dangers of the cloud with these providers with whom we do have clear privacy guidelines on our data protocols for encryption and, you know, not storing them unencrypted at rest and how they're, whether or not they're encrypted in motion, things like that. But these other people, we have an agreement with them maybe about an app we have, and then suddenly they have access to our data and they're moving it around behind the scenes. And that's really, really, really scary. And apparently everyone does it.
Yeah. The really odd thing about it is that the Path incident is a completely amateur mistake that anyone who is a CS major in any real university would understand never to do. And right. Yet, you know, because this is still sort of the Wild West with regard to being able to create, you know, have a really cool idea, come out with that really cool idea, maybe hire someone who knew how to write an HTML page, learned some PHP along the way, you know, via a For Dummies book or maybe even just online, but doesn't have a background in computer science and doesn't really understand what they're getting into. They make these systems that on their face, you know, they work, you know, clearly they work, but they are not sound. They're not secure. That also means that they are a very, very juicy target for people who are interested in glomming your data.
Well, sure. I mean, and that's the whole democratization of this building apps, you know, as it becomes easier and easier for, you know, people who were not programmers by profession or who have, you know, come to it later or come to it. At any rate, they're not, you know, didn't start out as a programmer, don't have a background in it. It makes it easier for them to create things like you're talking about. But on the flip side of that, too, apparently, I mean, this whole thing is like the elephant in the room for a lot of developers who know they're doing it and know that it's kind of janky. You know, it's kind of like the unspoken horror that they do just to make their things work. So, you know, apparently a lot of, you know, Yahoo and Facebook and whomever have been doing this as well.
Sure. They're going to cut corners because they're on deadline, or they think it's simply not critical. You know, it's not that their manager says, oh, this is not on critical path, so don't worry about it. Oh, we'll do it in the future. You know, there are so many excuses to do it the wrong way. And so they do. You know, or the worse is that they're ignorant and they don't realize what they're doing is wrong. Marco Arment, the fellow who created Instapaper, which is a fantastic app, by the way, I highly suggest checking it out. He wrote a big article on the whole path thing. It was basically on the idea of hashing and what path should have done, which was, spy on the address book if you want. First and foremost, ask for permission. That was a big no-no as well.
Right.
They didn't even bother asking for permission, which is, you know, apparently any app that is on your device can peer into your address book without your knowledge and do whatever it wants with it. There's no entitlement there. So it's basically a free access willy-nilly, which is a huge, weird problem. You know, you'd think that as a user, Apple would protect you against that, but it hasn't. I mean, they've said that they're going to in the future, but it's going to take some time to truly lock that down, because locking it down in such a way that doesn't break every app out there is going to take some time.
So, yeah, what you were just talking about from Marco, he also linked to Dustin Curtis' blog, who talked about this, and Curtis basically says, this is Apple's failure, that, you know, if we're anyone's to blame, it's Apple for allowing it to go on, turning a blind eye to it, and not having, like you said, this opt-in option for things. Why an app should have to ask me if it wants to, you know, access that stuff. It asks for everything else. Why not this?
Yeah, it asks for location data, and yet it doesn't ask whether or not, you know, you want your personal address book information uploaded to a random server, because that's really, really dangerous.
I mean, they were saying that someone talked to various developers and they were saying, yeah, we do this too. And hey, we have Zuckerberg's phone number and we have Bill Gates' phone number, you know, because it's sitting on our server. We got it without any, you know, they got it without any requirements, basically.
Right. Yeah. No,
they just, how they store it, how they transmit it, what happens to it.
And Path was using it in a very, not particularly, I mean, yes, in order to do their matching system, you need to find some sort of source, right? Which is based upon the friends that you are already friends with, or it can come from your Facebook friends or your Twitter friends or whatever, some other source.
Those things always ask you too, like, you know, if you want access to your Facebook friends or your Twitter list, you always get access. Ask that.
Well, that's part of the OAuth thing,
right?
So, and you start getting fatigued where everything is asking your OAuth. So while it's true, you don't ever give a third-party application your username and password, that's all very lovely, except that you are explicitly giving them permission to pretty much as if they were you at any point in time. The permissions, the granularity on the permission side for what any particular app can do on Facebook or on Twitter is way too big to be useful. So
yeah, it's fairly gross in its, you know, resolution. But
yeah, I mean, in general, they say we want the ability to add and modify your friends and tweet on your behalf and change lists and do all this sort of thing. And on one hand, I understand that you need to do that, because if you decide that you want to add someone, then that is the entitlement that you need to give the app. You are doing that. However, it's worded in such a way that it could do it on its own. For example, when you first launch the app, it's going to go through the OAuth process, and then you've allowed the app to add 10 new friends to your Twitter stream.
Right.
You know, it could be like random spam, whatever, but you've given permission to do that. And you may not even uncover that.
But on the flip side, I mean, if you're not even given the option, and if you are someone who is, you know, not fatigued or is very diligent about this sort of thing, you know, to not even have the option, you know, and there's plenty of times I go back and look at see what apps have been authorized for things, and sometimes I'll turn things on and off. But to not even be asked on something as important as my address book is just egregious.
And the big problem is that the solution to that is far more difficult than just putting in an alert, you know, right. Hey, do you want to do this?
Yeah, it needs to be, it's something that's missing from the whole programming paradigm. I use the word paradigm, but you know, but that's true. I mean, it's something very bare metal almost at this point. So it won't be simple to implement.
Right. And it's not really secure. You are allowing or disallowing certain apps to perform certain activities, right? Collect your data, change your data, what have you. There is no guarantee that once your data leaves your device, that it is in any way, shape, or form encrypted or kept in a secure space. None
right.
whatsoever. There's no way to trust any of these apps. The only way to, you know, not have everything eventually blow up in your face is to A, be very, very lucky, or B, more importantly, simply, well, there's always the don't use any of them. Also, don't ever put anything in there that is at all important. Make sure that you shut down location services so it never knows where you are. Don't say anything that may be used against you that can possibly be cross-referenced to some other thing that you're on. Clearly, don't put any important information out there. And if you're not going to do any of that, then you're really, you know, not using the services at all. And why bother using the app at that point?
Yeah, but you know, in the end, it's about deciding what you want to do. It's like, I know that if I'm using a certain app and I've allowed it access to, you know, my Twitter friends, it's, you know, that's something that it's something that I've given away, and I know that I've done it. Mm-hmm. Here the problem being, I don't know, and I wouldn't, like, for instance, the Facebook app, if it were to properly ask, do you want to give the Facebook access to, no, I would say no,
right?
Because I don't want that, because the way I use Facebook is different from the ways, you know, a lot of people use it. It has a very specific function, and what's in my address book is nothing related to what I do on Facebook. So no, but you know, not even having that option just makes it a moot point.
Oh yeah. To go along with this, we have the idea of, you know, whom can you trust? Can you trust the little guys because it's one guy who's a programmer and his face, his name is on the line, and so he seems or feels right. more accessible? But on the other hand, that maybe he's not a great programmer and maybe he's not thinking about things that maybe I would think of, or a more experienced programmer would have an understanding. Or do you trust the giant corporations that are so large you figure, well, duh, of course they'll do the right thing. Of course they, you know, because they have a lot of people under their roof, and of course they're thinking about safety and security and all that sort of thing. But then you take a look at Google, and you know, they just got caught creating crazy wacky JavaScripts that completely bypass some of the security measures in Safari and in Internet Explorer.
Yeah, totally asleep at the wheel up top.
Yeah.
I mean, and apparently, you know, this is not the first instance of them doing something similar.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know,
it's like, don't get caught being evil.
Right. It's like, well, okay, yeah, don't be evil. By the way, you need to go downstairs and have a look around.
Yeah.
Someone might be being evil.
Yeah, there's a lot of evil going around, you know. Seriously, how fucked up is that? What they did was they figured out how to do crazy JavaScript rewrites to URLs so that the allow third-party cookies preference in mobile Safari, actually in Safari in general,
gets
ignored, right? So it basically, regardless of the cookie's actual origin, it appears that the cookie is being read and written to by the domain that's in your address bar. And that's not the case. You know, in this case, it was, I think with Google, it was DoubleClick. They basically allowed the third-party DoubleClick cookies, including the big important ID, the DoubleClick ID cookie, which is the thing that follows you around the entire internet for all time, for all eternity. So it knows who you are, not knows who this random person is, but they know who you are by first and last name. They probably know your height, weight, eye color, etc. It's a little bit crazy. That is clearly, to me, I mean, not in a legal term, certainly, and I'm certainly far from a lawyer. To me, that is collusion to do bad things.
Yeah, that's about as dodgy a thing as Google's done in recent history. And it's, some people might not see it as so egregious, but I mean, to go out of your way to do this, and clearly knowing how it was going to affect certain users, you know, particularly Safari users.
Right. I mean, it wasn't something like, oh, we're doing this and oh, it has this weird side effect of this problem.
Exactly.
It was they specifically had a problem that they needed to solve. And that problem was, we need to be able to allow DoubleClick and their buddies to track people who don't wish to be tracked. So how right. do we get around those security measures?
They programmatically changed the definition of third party. You know, it's like, what is the definition of is? You know, it's like, so, well, what if we made these third-party cookies weren't so third-party anymore? You know, it's basically what they did.
Yeah. Through JavaScript, they rewrote what the application thought was the current domain.
Right. And I'm sure they rationalized it away. You know, they're 2.5 party. I don't know.
Yeah. It's just, it's so ridiculous. It was, I mean, it's just, it's scummy. Is what it is.
It's very scummy.
So shame on you, Google. Get your shit straight.
Jerks.
Well, cool. So where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter at TANKGRRL. Or if you want to find the broader, fatter me, broader in the broader sense, about.me/MaggieMcPhee. And where can we find you, sir?
You can also find me in the Twitters as at Octothorpe. You can also find me on my personal blog at localtype.org. And also, you can find Ruining It For Everyone on Twitter at RI4, and that's the numeral 4E. So, subscribe, have fun, and we'll see you next time.
That was another episode of Ruining It For Everyone with your hosts Maggie McPhee and Christopher Harrington. Music provided by Kevin MacLeod. You can find us at ruiningitforeveryone.tv or search for Ruining It For Everyone on iTunes. Be sure to subscribe and rate the show, as it really helps us out.
So maybe...
All right, I'll start my answer over there.
Okay.
Oh, good night.
Adobe Device Monkey.